Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to look at how eating hot peppers can decrease your risk of dying, University of Vermont, and how compounds in marijuana are promising treatment for cardiac disease, University of Hawaii, and workouts with fewer reps but more weight could yield better results, University of Stirling, which is in the United Kingdom, and how if you lack vitamin B6, that is bad for cognitive functioning, Ulster University, which is in Ireland, and protecting the telomeres deaccelerates aging. So I'm going to share several nutrients that are known to allow you to live longer because they protect the telomeres, and hence there's no reason you shouldn't be able to add between 10 and 15 years onto your active lifespan. Our audio clips today, based upon all this going on in the media, I wanted to give a different perspective. For example, there's a journalist who was just died yesterday, I believe, who had the most open, honest, and frank discussion about how he had been working for the CIA as an asset. Now, he's not an insignificant journalist. He is a major German journalist. And he had a very open and honest talk about what it means to be living in two worlds. One, where you're supposed to be telling the truth as a journalist, and the other, you're being told what to write, how to write it, what conclusions you should have, all behind the scenes. We know at one time there were over 1,400 people from the CIA working with news institutions around the world. In fact, there was not many places where you could go to get completely honest and objective reporting. It's worse today. We'll have that conversation. Also, Glenn Greenwald talks about this memo in the CIA in Russia. I think you'll find this interesting. And one of the people talked about by our national security director was Russian TV, and specifically Abby Martin. Well, if that's how accurate he is, then he really has missed the boat, because Abby Martin has been at RTV in more than 2 years, and not once could we find anything wrong with her reporting. Like Julian Assange, with over 10 million documents released, they have never been found to have released an inaccurate document. So think for a moment. Here's the issue. Yes, we don't want people being able to come in and spy on our phone conversations, our government agencies, how we operate. But that's assuming that our government is operating in the best interest of the American people. What these disclosures show is that they haven't been, and they've actually been working against the interest of the American people. So now the attack in the media is on the source of the release of information, not on the content of what is being said. So if you don't want people exposing your criminal behavior, stop your criminal behavior. And if someone should be so disgusted by what they're seeing working in an agency that they decide to take a thumb drive, download the documents, get it out to Julian Assange, don't blame Assange for reporting accurately. Julian Assange has never reported, not once in their 10-year existence, inaccurate material. So when the Podesta files came out, and the National Democratic Committee files were revealed, it was all so much about the dirty side of politics. So now, to cover themselves, they blame the Russians. Well, of course the Russians are going to spy, but who led them? Who's the biggest spyer in the world? We are. Who violates more people's emails and governments around the world? We do. So we're really smart here. We're the ones who have the biggest spy operations. We have not respected any country's sovereignty or any person's privacy. Yet we become offended when someone reports on our bad doings. So Abby responds to that. I think you'll find her response interesting. Also today, in honoring Martin Luther King, I wanted to deal with the importance and urgency of his message. And so I've invited William Pepper, an international civil and human rights attorney, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray. Pepper and King were friends. In fact, in 1967, Dr. King had reached out to Dr. Pepper regarding an essay he had written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions. He was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. So we're going to have him on to share his insights and what messages we can learn from today. If time permits, a commentary from Chris Hedges, Building Institutions for Revolt, from Truth Dig, and from Professor Michael Brenner, who is a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, America's Self-Destructive Obsessions. Let's begin. We always begin with something on health and healing because we all want to live longer and healthier lives. And I've always wondered around the world in those cultures that are eating very spicy foods, far hotter than anything you could reasonably find in America, cuisine, why? And it's not just a preference for taste, because at a certain point in heat units, you lose the capacity for really differentiating taste. It's just hot. But then you start looking at Ayurvedic medicine, you in India, and you look at traditional Japanese medicine, Korean medicine, and you see that they understand the healing power of heat in foods. And of course, then in Mexico and South America, the same thing. Now, let's just say that you don't have proper hygiene, you don't have refrigeration, and you know that eating something that is putrefying could cause you to die. What if you had something that could counteract some of those? Well, cooking does, but so do spices, especially if it's hot. This is from the University of Vermont, and it was published in PLOS One Scientific Journal. If you like spicy foods, you might live longer. Researchers at Lamar College of Medicine at the University of Vermont have found the consumption of hot red chili peppers is associated with a 13%, that's huge, reduction in total death, primarily in deaths due to heart disease or stroke. Now, this is a large prospective study. Now, let's put this in proper context. If you were to go back centuries, peppers and spices have been thought to be beneficial in the treatment of disease. But only in one study conducted in China and published in 2015 has previously examined chili pepper consumption and is associated with death. Now, there's thousands of studies that don't deal with death, but this deals with death. And the new study corroborates the earlier study's findings. Using National Health and Nutrition Examination surveys, they collected data on 16,000 Americans and followed these people for 23 years. And they took a careful look and found out that those who consumed the hot red chili peppers tended, quote, to have a longer life. And they examined data from a medium follow-up of 18.9 years and observed the number of deaths and then analyzed specific cause of death. Quote, although the mechanisms by which peppers could delay mortality is far from certain, transient receptor potential channels, which are primary receptors for pungent agents such as capsaicin, the principal component in chili peppers, may in part be responsible for the observed relationship. Now, I can give you a better explanation because I have conducted over 43 human clinical lifestyle and behavior modification studies. By the way, just for the record, that is more than anyone else in American history. Some of these have taken as long as 2 years. The latest one was 3 months. And the brain healing was 16 months. And in every single one, I advocate cayenne peppers or hot peppers. And you can eat them, which is good, but you can't control how many heat units you're getting when you're eating a pepper. But if you buy the capsules, you can, because it's 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 heat units, and generally 40,000 to 60,000 is great. Why? Because when you have that chili pepper in your blood, it thins the blood. It helps eliminate a lot of the clotting factor. The aggregation of red blood cells that come together create a clot that can then become an ischemic episode, a stroke or a heart attack. So by taking chili peppers in the morning, or heat capsule of chili pepper, and one at night before you go to bed, you're preventing a stroke during the day and then at night during at night. And that is the primary way that it helps. It also helps healing. It turns off inflammation in the brain. Therefore, it's good for people with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, memory loss. It turns off heat in the joints, helping people with arthritis, in the musculature, bursitis, and fibromyalgia, and in the intestine, the different itises, ileitis, spastic colon, diverticulitis. It is hot, but it's a healing hot. And it lowers blood pressure also. So one of nature's wonderful healing functional foods, which is the hot pepper, we in the United States have tended not to use. In fact, it was over 150 years in American history before some of the spicing of foods from the Southwest, and hence the whole Tex-Mex phenomena, came north. And it took until after Fanny Farmer, America's most famous chef, back in the 1890s at her famous cooking school up in Boston, where spices that were hot were used at all. And they didn't use the spices. They used salt and pepper. And that was it. Or cooking in high fat, butter. That was a very common use to give flavor to food, because fat is what is most flavorful. In any case, think about taking some hot pepper. A new study from the Department of Cell and Molecular Biology, University of Hawaii, and the Burn School of Medicine found that marijuana has compounds that could help with the treatment of cardiac disease. And that's important. Quote, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death globally, accounting for more than 17 million deaths per year, a number that is expected to grow to more than 23 million in the upcoming future. And we spend about $316 billion in the United States alone every year on this. In fact, we have equal to 1 to 3 deaths every 40 seconds in the United States from heart disease. So they found these compounds that make a difference. And you've heard me mention many times, the cannabinoids. And it's in the native plant, and they extract that. You don't get it when you smoke it. You get it from extraction. And it has a significant effect on the TRPV1 receptors that purified cannabinoids have. So if you have heart disease of any type, the scientific literature has scientific, independent, peer-review-based research showing you that cannabinoids could help you. And by the way, it also helps with brain cancer, lung cancer, strokes, and seizures. Now, for those of us who work out, the question is always, should I do higher reps with less weight or fewer reps with heavier weight? And the tendency has been to do long reps till you get the burn. So let's say you're doing a push-up or a curl or a sit-up. You might do 50 sit-ups or 100 sit-ups till you burn. Or you might lift weights as a curl, 20 pounds, 10 times, till you burn. Now the research, according to the University of Stirling in the United Kingdom, is that you do fewer reps, higher weight, and you benefit more from them. So this was done at the Exercise Science and the Faculty of Health Sciences and Sport. So that's it. So my suggestion is that you do maybe 3/4 the reps, but go up in weight. I generally tell people, do 20 reps 3 times with a 2-minute break in between. And do it to where you couldn't do 22. 20 is the max. That gives you the massive benefits. Now, also, if you took creatine monohydrate and the branched chain amino acids prior to the workout, then when you're doing that burn, you're also building muscle and burning fat. And from Ulster University in Ireland, vitamin B6 deficiency is linked to cognitive decline, meaning when you're low in vitamin B6, and I suggest 25 to 50 milligrams a day, that low B6 contributes to cognitive decline. So the other vitamins B complex don't show that. So that's important. So I suggest a B complex, 50 milligrams of each day, and you'll be fine. B1, B2, B6, plus 1 milligram of methylated B12 and 1 milligram of methylated folic acid. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. All over the world, people are listening. I thank you for joining us each day and also for going to our website and downloading articles every 24 hours throughout at least 20 hours a day. We're posting. And how do we select the postings? Well, I do about 100 myself. The others are done by people that we hire who know what a progressive article is, and also an article that the challenges those in power, including the political and institutional control mechanisms of our society. And we also keep our themes universal. So it wouldn't matter where you were, you could appreciate that information. And I like to put articles up that show the best of human nature. So anytime someone does something that is selfless, that is good for motivating us, I put those. I also love nature shots, the wonder of nature. Some of the places in this country, including our own country, are just magnificent and breathtaking. And then animals. I love animals. I have a rescue program where I rescue over 3,000 animals, rehabilitate them, find them homes, and have never had to euthanize an animal. Never. Always found them a home. And so anytime I see a story where an animal is doing something unique, like last week, it was a group of African wild dogs that are extraordinarily efficient hunters. There's so many of them. There could be 40 of them. And they have great endurance. So not one could bring an animal down, but 40 can. In fact, there's a video I saw once where a big tiger, was attacked by wild dogs, and it killed 20. That's a lot. But then it lost its energy, and they killed it and ate it. So is nature. So here these dogs were going after this small buffalo, and clearly it didn't have a chance. And out of nowhere comes this hippopotamus. And those are big, big creatures. No one messes with a hippopotamus, and chases off and then protects that. I love those kind of scenes. Or where you see the relationship between animals to each other. So, and then the hard-hitting articles and the original reports. By the way, we try to post an original. We write it ourselves. I write it. Our scholars and residents write them. Original in-depth investigative reports, at least 1 to 2 per month. Right now, we've been working for over 6 months on a 10-part series that'll begin next Monday. It's called The Politics of Cancer, Our Medical Vietnam. And it is the longest, most definitive article ever written in American history on cancer. And it's in parts, like we show all the places that promise they'll do something with your money, the marches, the wearing the pink, and this, the Komen Foundation. I really expose them all. Then the treatments don't work, and the doctors know they don't work, because I cite their own literature showing it doesn't work, yet they're continuing to make billions of dollars a year collectively from it. And then we show the therapies that do work, but why you wouldn't know about them. And I only write about therapies that I've personally gone there, personally reviewed the information, waited 5 years to see do these people who had cancer were treated relapse or not. And those that do not relapse, those who stay healthy and cancer-free after 5 years, those are the only ones that meet the high standards we have. Those we'll be sharing with you. So it's coming, a whole 10-part series just on cancer. But we have over 747 articles I've personally written up there, and always something important. So go and take a look for yourself. It's free. It's all there as a public service. Now, many of us, I'm sure many of you, are concerned that we have become a warlike culture. And as a result, it's very easy for people in the media to bring on these talking heads like the Judith Millers and or the Oliver Norris or whoever it may be. And they promote the idea that we should be terrified, we should be afraid, and therefore we should over-defend ourselves. And here's the irony. People living in poverty, people who have so little and are so restricted in their quality of life, are nodding their head in agreement when these enormously large military-industrial complex corporations receive all the money they want. And when they make a mistake, they're subsidized even more. It's called cost-plus contracts. And as you have heard me say, there's over 200,000 of these in Washington, D.C. alone. And so they're like a vortex that sucks in money that we could completely de-ghettoize all of America. We could change all of the underlying infrastructures, repair it, got new. We could have a rail system, a high-quality rail system, so you didn't have to fly and wouldn't pollute with cars, that could get you safely from New York to L.A., from Chicago to Florida, from Texas to Oklahoma in hours. But we're not doing it because all of our money goes through the Clintons and the Obamas and the Bushes. It doesn't matter who's in office. It's irrelevant, absolutely irrelevant. If you put Porky Pig as president of the United States, it would not make one bit of difference. You've got to understand, none of these people do anything except facilitate for those who are in power. And so we don't have these infrastructures. We don't have de-ghettoization. We don't have good housing. We don't have good schools. We don't have an honest addressment of our environmental problems because the military-industrial complex. And they have got to keep themselves relevant. And they do this through our self-destructive obsessions. Do you remember growing up, at least if you're a baby boomer or older? I'm sure you read Moby Dick. And if you did, then you remember Captain Ahab and his obsession with the whale. And it was driven by the thirst for revenge. Now, according to Professor Michael Brenner, the great white whale have maimed Ahab, but in soul and in body. Ahab was consumed by the passion to restore his sense of self and make himself whole again. How do you do that? Well, you kill the nemesis. That's a compulsion, and it never dies. So America's war on terror has become our national mission of restoration. What do I mean? I mean the psychic wound of 9/11 is what grieves us. It inflames our collective passion for vengeance. The physical wound is already healed, and no terrorist represents any real threat to America unless they detonate a nuclear power plant, because anything they destroy will rebuild and even better, and they can't destroy the lives of 330 million Americans, though we've been led to believe that we should be held in mortal fear, a hostage to this. By now, it must be memorialized in order for the scar to be seen. It never did impair our functioning, in that sense, little more than a broken toe. In the aftermath of 9/11, there was genuine fear of a repeat attack, something that we now know never was in the cards. Our enemy has been emasculated. The great Satan was shot dead in Pakistan. Only pinpricks at long intervals from within our midst draw blood. We have to understand that we still seethe with emotions. We suffer from the embedded anxiety that is dread, from uneasy feelings of vulnerability, from a seeming lost prowess and control. A society that talks casually about closure on almost all occasions cannot find closure on 9/11. Instead, the society has a powerful need to ritualize the fear, to pursue the implacable quest for ultimate security, to perform violent acts of vengeance that neither cure nor satiate. So, we search the seven seas, hunting for monsters to slay, not Moby Dick himself, but his accessories, accomplices, enablers, facilitators, emulators, sympathizers, whales of every species, great and small, fall to our harpoons. The dead and innocent dolphins far outnumbered even the smallest of whales. That's just the fortunes of war. Since there is no actual Moby Dick out there to pursue, we have fashioned a virtual game of acting out the hunt, the encounter, the retribution. We thereby have embraced the post 9/11 trauma rather than surrendering it. That is the war on terror. The war is about us. It is no longer about them. Ahab destroyed himself, destroyed his crew, destroyed his ship. He sacrificed everything in the quest, a quest for the unattainable. The United States is sacrificing its principles of liberty, its political integrity, the trust that is the bedrock of its democracy, its standing in the world as the best hope of mankind, and its capability and capacity to feel for others, including its fellow citizens. America's Moby Dick has migrated and transmuted itself. It now is lodged in our innermost being. There it spawns fictive offspring, such as Vladimir Putin. But the Putins of this world, they are projective of our existential dread, the spectral persona that haunts our minds. Putin has no objective existence. Putin is the creation of our troubled national psyche. We have transposed onto him the whole maelstrom of turbid emotions which we had imparted to Osama bin Laden and then to the Islamic State. To rid of this transmuted Moby Dick, we must kill part of our tainted being, a form of psychopolitical chemotherapy. Otherwise, our national soul will wither away just as Ahab was sucked into the ocean depths and tangled in the very ropes he had fashioned to ensnare Moby Dick. And remember, please, that I have said many times on this program that we created ISIS. We created the crisis in the world. We created al-Nusra. We created al-Qaeda. We created all this through the commingling of political and neo-political interests, the neoliberal interest, the globalist interest, by creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Everything is portended from that. And just use reason for a moment. What do you think would happen if you have a family? Let's say you have a large family, between aunts and uncles and grandparents and grandchildren, cousins and nieces, you have 40 people. That's the average size of an extended Muslim family. And let's say that someone that you had never seen, had never spoken with, you have never dialogued with, decided to invade and occupy your land, and in the process terrorize you, your family, awake in the middle of the night, threatened, innocent people put in prison, young boys and young girls raped, many killed. And therefore you became a migrant in your own land. You did not have the normal day-to-day facilitation of life, quality of life. You cannot rely upon a refrigerator having frozen or cold food because you only had 1 hour of electricity a day. You dared not go into a block that you had habitually gone to because it had become balkanized and you could be killed. You became a prisoner in your own home. How would you feel about the oppressor? Who amongst you, after seeing death, destruction, and carnage, would rebel and say, I will sacrifice my life against that oppressor? America is the number one creator of terror in the world. We are facilitated by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, the American, the immigrants, seven nations, the immigrants, and Qatar is also the home of Al Jazeera, so they have a great propaganda arm. And then we impose our rights to enter countries with special forces. We are in 80% of all the countries in the world with special forces. We operate over 1,000 bases overseas. We spend over $100 billion a year on these operations. And so everyone involved in this process, both retired and acting as consultants outside of retirement, admirals, joint chiefs of staff, facilitators of that corporate need to create fear. And yet, where is there a single Gandhi? Where is there a Martin Luther King as our ambassadors of detente and goodwill? When do they send that message that we are not here to oppress you, to control you, to manipulate you, to terrorize you, to exploit your resources, to put you in debt, and then punish you again once you're in debt? Where are those ambassadors? We send out the worst of human nature in the form of our secretaries of state, carrying on the policies of hegemony. Our only interest is in that which we can conquer, whether it's nations, their peoples, Native Americans. Everywhere we have touched, we have taken a branding iron and seared into the consciousness and the real flesh of those people. You no longer are you. You are an extension and property of our corporate interest. That is the truth of it. And I believe that as a nation, we must stand up against all of it. And that's why I do not see a good Democrat or a good Republican. I do not see a good corporate liberal, corporate conservative. All I see is the malignant, ever-growing, completely tenacious, amoral, indifferent, lacking in compassion and sensitivity, our entire political apparatchik. I believe that we must stand, confront them, and engage in civil disobedience. And if you are fearful, then your civil disobedience could be stop using their credit cards, stop buying their clothes, stop buying their food, stop watching their programs, and hence take away your personal support. For those who believe in more concrete action, let us join in public boycotts to show them you are not going to brand me. I am not your property. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting through our studios in New York City. I'm out on location. In a second, we're going to go to Dr. William Pepper, who is standing by, to talk about his relationship with Martin Luther King and what he believes we should do other than just having a holiday, which is meaningless, and that's for everything we have holidays for. How many times do we stop and ask, what is the real meaning of this day? What can I do to honor that legacy? We'll be asking him that. I also want to mention that those who are listening to this program, if you listen live in North America, which, by the way, Canada is North America, you can listen by telephone or any portable listening device, including your computer. Let me give you that number to listen live, Monday to Friday, noon to 1, and Tuesday, 7 to 8. That number is 605-562-5119, 605-562-5119. But 99% of people listen to this program at night over the internet. And here's the phone number you can also listen anywhere you're at. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And just to give you, I was going through a Denver airport. I just finished a special there recently, and it was very early in the morning, and I had to catch a flight out. And as I go up the counter, no one else is there, and this man is looking intently down, and I wait about 3 or 4 minutes, and then he looked up, and he says, "Oh, I'm listening to you." I said, "What do you?" He says, "You're Gary Nolles." "Yes." He says, "I'm listening to your podcast from last night." So you can listen at any time by the internet. Let's say hello to my guest standing by, William Pepper. I mentioned his bio earlier today. Nice to have you with us, William.
Gary, it's good to be with you.
William, before we touch upon some of the issues surrounding the role of the deep state in the assassination of Martin Luther King, I feel that we might want to look at the relevancy of King's message and where the world would be today if he, not Carrier, Hillary Clinton, were going to countries and advising us on how to deal with people in the Muslim world, how to deal with people in South America and other countries, how to deal with Russia, who are not our enemies. Russia's not planning on, nor would it be stupid enough to invade anyone right now, and it hasn't. We're the ones who are doing this, and yet we're blaming everyone else but ourselves. It's like a mirror we refuse to look in. So tell us about what you believe would be King's position today, especially in light of the Trump and the Trump and his cabinet made up all of people who, and I share a little different view than some of the other people. See, I see the destruction of Trump coming from the very fact that he has been perfect, absolutely flawless in selecting only megalomaniac sociopaths like himself. So had he put an actual progressive, actually put a populist in positions of power, then it would have given some temperament adjustment. But he's put everybody in power who made lots of money for themselves but have never made a nickel for anyone else nor saved anyone else. So you know how this is going to work out. These people are not going to change. I don't care what you want to do to make a great white shark into a dolphin that you can kiss and pet. You're not going to do it. And this is where the lack of appreciation of what happens when you allow someone just to absolutely over-connive, over-conceive, and then watch the destruction happen. I believe it'll be within 6 months. But if Gandhi were here today, I'm pretty sure I have an understanding how he would deal with this. I want you to tell us how you believe, since Martin Luther King and Gandhi both shared the common element of staunch advocates of nonviolence. In fact, during his Nobel Prize speech in 1964, Martin Luther King compared humankind's technological advantage with our spiritual progress. But he noted that humanity has fallen greatly behind its spirituality in order to keep up with the issues associated with scientific and technological advancement. He said, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." Your thoughts, please.
I think you put it very well. But I think we have gotten much closer to spiritual death than we were during Martin King's time. He saw this coming, and he actually saw, and we had these discussions, he saw the motivation and the value of values of capitalism and the epitome of greed, which characterized the system as the antithesis of a spiritual existence. He saw them in conflict back in 67, 68. I only knew him the last year of his life, and it was the war that brought us together because of my work as a journalist in Vietnam and in 66, and a Ramparts piece that he read that caused him to ask to meet with me. And we went into these issues now. I think your analysis of Martin's commitment to nonviolent resistance to the despiritualization of his native country and culture was profound. What he would want to see happen today is one of the things that certainly that you've begun to discuss is massive civil disobedience against the system and its values. Remember, they killed him, in my view, primarily because he was going to bring 500,000 people for this exact purpose to Washington, D.C., not to march. Marches come and go, but to camp in the shadow of the Washington Memorial and then to confront the members, the elected members of the Congress and the Senate to take money back from the militarization of the society and to put it into social programs that had been denied for so long. A major concern was what we see, and we see the result of this today, a major concern of his was the growth of economic inequality and the impoverishment of large numbers of people. And here we have an administration about to take root, and they're talking about virtually wiping out the health insurance of upwards of 30 million people who never had it before. There are many problems with Obama's health insurance, and as you have gone on for quite a while about we absolutely need universal health care as a human right, and it should be a non-profit system, not one that's geared for profits, the insurance companies any more than the hospitals, doctors, device manufacturers. And he saw, as did Mr. Roosevelt, health care as a basic human right and as one that is taken from the voiceless. And that we're going to go through that again. And I think only massive civil disobedience and organization, nonviolent organization and pressure is going to force this to a head. It nothing short of, in my view, Gary, nothing short of a revolution in this system, of this total system, not on an issue by issue, point by point basis, but of the total system of exploitation, which we have now exported around the world. And not only have we militarized the police forces of our cities, but we have spread through the overseas bases and the military presence around the world, exploitation of countless hundreds of millions of people.
I appreciate those insights. By the way, Bill, tomorrow I wrote it this morning, a commentary on comparing civil disobedience when I first became civilly disobedient, writing articles in the Wheeling newspaper against the war in Vietnam, then coming to New York and engaging, writing and doing posters and whatnot, and everything since then, compared to what a new generation sees as civil disobedience. And I believe that the new generation should stop for a moment and just take a look at the historical movements going back to the 1800s, the miners' revolts in West Virginia, and the children's, on behalf of the children who were engaged in slave labor in the mines, and even the abolitionists and the suffragettes. We must look at all these different groups and see what lessons can we learn from their sacrifices, because they were really out there in harm's way. And I don't believe it's enough just to show up and march, because marches in and of itself don't mean diddly squat, and they know it. Then someone says, I did my march, I did my thing, I contributed. And they go home, and the people in power just kind of look at this and mawkishly say, well, that wasn't bad. Then stop buying their clothes, and that is bad. You got to hit them financially. But that, be that as it may, you made a comment I want to address. It was Martin Luther King who said, somehow we must transform the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race, which no one can win, to a positive contest to harness man's creative genius for the purpose of making peace and prosperity a reality for all the nations of the world. In short, we must shift the arms race into a peace race. If we have the will and determination to mount such a peace offensive, we will unlock hitherto tightly sealed doors and transform our immediate cosmic elegy into a plasma of creative fulfillment, end quote. And now you look, juxtapose Two men win the Nobel Peace Prize, Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. Obama has been the most militaristic, corporatist president in American history. He has caused more illegal aliens to be exported than any other president. He has harassed more whistleblowers and had them arrested under the Espionage Act than anyone else. And he currently has seven wars going on. We're bombing in seven countries around the world, 23,600 bombs last year, this year alone. And yet no one sees him for the deeds and actions he has done. They only see him for his very pleasant and very cosmopolitan and very literate attitude. And behind that is an extraordinarily neoliberal, hegemonic person. So he is putting $1.5 trillion into continuing the nuclear race. At the same time, Martin Luther King was saying, get out of the nuclear race, use that money for deeds that are good. That said, I just, because you, something in my mind tripped that remembrance when you said that, I'd like for you to spend the rest of our time talking about the people who took out Martin Luther King, because the vast majority of Americans still believe that a lone gunman, James Earl Ray, shot him. Could you summarize what you have proven, what you've actually proven in a court of law, under oath, all your evidence? Take us on that journey, but don't spend a lot of time on anyone, because it's such a big theme that we won't get through it. If you could give us the highlights from who started the assassination plan, who participated in it, how did they do it, how do you know they did it, and who is still alive today who is a part of that that we should know about?
Right. Well, that is a big order. Let me try to summarize as best I can. I've covered it, as you know, in the final book, the third book of three, on the assassination, and that it's virtually closed it for me, because we did reach the end of the road. I represented the King family in trial in 1999. We eventually, though, came with the full story at the end of 2015, when the last depositions were ready. Martin King, political assassinations throughout all of history, so we shouldn't think that this is just the ones that happened in America in the 60s are unique. Throughout all of history, political assassinations are the last resort that a power structure, ruling forces use when an individual or individuals become intolerable, when there's no other way to, when they can't co-opt them, they can't corrupt them, contaminate them in some way, or buy them off, which are the more common ways that are done in the progressives. And that's why what sets you apart, by the way, Gary, because the progressive media in many ways is more dangerous than corporate mainstream media, because it pretends to be something that at the end of the day it isn't. There are areas that they simply will not go. And to your credit, you go over that breach, and you do cover these issues. Martin King was typical in many ways of a victim of political assassination. He had reached a point where they couldn't control him. He had vast sources of human energy behind him and human beings behind him. He had the credibility to sway people. And when he opposed the war, he was going into hitting directly at the bottom lines of major American corporations who were making money from the war. One of my pieces of evidence was Colonel John Downey, who was a CIA briefer of Lyndon Johnson. He used to kept asking him, why are we in this senseless war? And finally, after months of this kind of questioning in the regular sessions, Johnson looked at him and pounded the table and said, John, I can't get out of this war. My friends are making too much money. So that underlies every military adventure and everything you have talked about, everything that is going on by the executive and the legislative foot soldiers of the ruling forces of the society. It has to do with them making money and compounding that over long periods of time. Obama, you're quite right, Obama has been given now a false legacy. He and without any question stands in the shoes of other war criminals who will go unprosecuted because of the bombing that you've just talked about and the particularly the acceleration use of drones on, against civilians. But that's not being raised. That won't be raised by any media, really, other than people like you, and there are very few like you who will do it. Martin was intolerable. He was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington to camp, and the military was convinced that they would get nowhere with their congressman, and there would be no reshuffling of funds, and so therefore he had to be stopped, because they were convinced that there would be a revolution in the streets of Washington. Remember, 100 cities had burned that year. There was virtually a revolution that was co-opted in Paris, in France against De Gaulle. So the whole world was on edge, and they were afraid that that revolution was going to take place. So he was never going to be allowed to leave Memphis. They were going to make sure that that he was killed. The foot soldiers in the ruling class at that time, of course, included members of the agency, but in particular, in terms of actions, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI took the lead in this assassination, and I distinguish that because the roles in others were quite different. As you know, I represent Sirhan as well, who did not kill Robert Kennedy, and the forces behind the Kennedy assassination on the ground were different than those in King. So Hoover took the lead, and what we didn't know for a long time was that he was funding it. He was funding a Dixie Mafia group, and he was sending Clyde Tolson, his deputy and assistant, in regularly to meet with the Dixie Mafia family that organized things on the ground with the local political officials and the chief of police and fire, Frank Holloman. So it was Tolson who brought the money in 1966, late 66, brought $25,000 in. It was taken to the prison where James Earl Ray had been profiled as being an ideal patsy. That $25,000 was given to the warden to arrange James's escape. We never had an idea that they actually planned that escape, but they planned it, carried it out, and then put James in the control of a handler. And that was a year before the assassination. They had prepared that groundwork and control James, move him around until they could get him in the right at the right time and the right place for the assassination to take place. Now, the people on the ground organized a shooter, but the military had a backup operation, and that backup operation had contained two shooters and two spotters, and they were in Memphis, having got there earlier that day and taken up their positions, but they were really only to be used as a backup, and they did not kill Martin King. Martin was shot by a Memphis police officer who was hired to do the job. He was the best shot on the police force. I had lunch with this guy about 5-6 months ago. He's still alive. And after the lunch, some colleague of mine he's driving a taxi cab, jumped into the back of his cab, and he's known him for 25 years, and said to him, it looks like Pepper's on your case, and they're going to indict you on the King matter. And he turned and in a bit of a panic, he said, what are they going to get me for something I did 30 years ago or knew about 30 years ago? So there was no question that this was the guy who was to be the hitman. And I had an eyewitness who watched him receive the rifle in the rifle range out of the armory, police armory, and practice all day the day of the shooting until he left the place at 3 o'clock. I put this witness under oath, and we filmed him, deposed him, but I couldn't use it because he saw everything, and they knew that he was there in a position to see everything, and various events in his life let him know they were watching him under surveillance, and they would have killed him. So I couldn't use that for a number of years. Until after he died.
Okay, Bill, we only have a couple minutes. Just answer yes or no to the following. Did Martin Luther King, was he still alive when he was taken to the hospital?
Yes, he was.
Did you interview a witness who was there when that witness saw the doctor in the hospital kill Martin Luther King?
Yes, I have two eyewitness independent verifications that Martin King was never going to be allowed to leave that hospital. The doctor was the family doctor of the Dixie Mafia family, the Adkins family. The son was present when the doctor said weeks earlier, make sure he gets to St. Joseph's and we'll make sure he doesn't leave alive. And the second witness was a surgical nurse who was ordered out of the room by the doctor when he was there with two men in suits. She saw the catheter pulled out. She saw them spit on the body as she was leaving the room. The gathering up of the spit is what caught her attention. And then she turned and she saw that chief of surgery take the pillow and put it over Martin's face. And
what was his name?
Dr. Breen Bland was his name.
And finally, do you have any evidence that suggests that a major current and popular civil rights leader could have been associated with this?
Yes, I do, and it had to do with the change of rooms. Martin's room was to be in 202. He was moved to 306 because of the intervention of the person you're referring to, and I had an eyewitness who was present when those instructions were given for the room change.
And who is that person?
Jesse Jackson.
Thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it, Bill.
Good to hear you, Gary.
Dr. William Pepper, the world's leading expert on Martin Luther King's death. He has spent over 30,000 hours researching it and actually won in court in a civil case to show that James Earl Jones was not the killer. I'm Gary Nall. Let's honor King for his legacy and could only imagine how the world would be if he were alive today. Thank you for listening.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you. Forever, forever, you'll stay in my heart. For the bus, dear, while riding, I think of us, dear.